Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and we're taking a break this week from the Venice Architecture Biennale with Karsten Paulsen. This is going to reflect Dan's recent visit to Scandinavia, where, of course, I did not have a chance to drop by through Copenhagen, where Karsten is based, but he is the founder, owner, and CEO of Paulsen Urbanism, where he advocates the practice of humane cities. And if this, of course, sounds familiar, it's because we know that there is a soft spot in every global North urbanist's heart for Copenhagen. And, of course, the idea of building urban districts at that sort of human scale, made famous by another Danish architect whose name we won't mention in deference to Karsten. But thank you for coming on, Karsten, and joining us here on Unfrozen. Your presence is quite a contrast to our last episode, where we ended the discussion by talking about Neom, the line, and cities built from scratch in the desert. As a way of starting, Karsten, what is humane cities, and what is your advocation of what urbanism should be?
Well, I think I will start by telling about a little about my childhood, because I think for everybody it's more important than you might think. I grew up in a quarter in Copenhagen called Vesterbro, which is one of these areas from around 1900, was built rapidly with inspiration from Vienna and Berlin outside the old center. So there I lived on the fourth floor with my family, where we had our privacy, neighbors that we could talk to, and then we could walk down the stairs into the public space, the streets and squares, where I learned to see people and to talk to them and see how different people could be. I found my way to school after my parents told me how to come there by myself. Later on, my school was a little further away, and I could use my bicycle or take my tram car. So that's my, and everything was walkable, almost. And so it sits deeply into me that this is my background. And then I have been working professionally with renovation, all this stock of buildings from around 1900, which we have a lot of in Copenhagen, very large part, luckily in Copenhagen, that were renovated in the 1990s. Today the building stock is still there, and the dark backyards that they had in my time as a child have been greened now. They have been like green areas for the people in the block, so they have their neighbors, they have their privacy, so they have this European classical combination of your privacy in the backyards, and when you step into the street, you're in the public realm and behave like that. So in this sense, all these buildings still exist. And so I sense in all this very, very important matter of sustainability, I think it is a superb example of sustainability. It's dense urban areas without high-rise buildings, but pretty dense. It's a good example of a sustainable building.
If I can be a little bit challenging, from the beginning, what is new here? Because these seem like principles that have been embraced by the architecture and planning community for a long time, if not executed very frequently in cities that don't already have the privilege of good urban planning from more than a century ago. So the premise of your book is that there are 10 design principles for contemporary planning. You cover from cultural heritage to the townhouse to streets and squares, and you sort of describe the ideal that you kind of grew up in and define some principles that grow out from that. I guess what I'm asking is what's new here? Because a lot of urbanists have embraced this kind of format of living previously, and I'm just trying to figure out what the angle is.
Okay. I get you. Yeah. When I wrote my first book in English called How to Design Humane Cities, one of my critics, I got some good critics, and I had the reviews in the Danish newspapers. One of the headlines was a defense for the organic dense city. And that's in fact what I'm doing. So you can see to a lot of a great extent it's a new wine on old bottles. But for me, it's important to keep these principles in mind in these years where a lot of things happen with high rise and spread blocks, not bad planning, missing planning, and a weakness of the city governments, of the planners. No architect, city architect of Copenhagen has really no power. So they had for 15, 20 years ago. Today it's the developers who get access to the Lord Mayor's office and make the deals, and after that it comes down to the planners, where the architects and landscape architects and engineers are sitting. So that's the picture in Copenhagen, where you were known as called the wonderful city. I agree, it's a wonderful city, but I want to defend it because I see a lot of tendencies to, instead of unity and homogeneous facades, to make enclaves, to make small attempts to make gated communities. We are not there yet, but the kind of the building in enclaves where a specific developer is getting, and it's now we are talking about the edge of the city, because Copenhagen is developing. So in these years of crisis in Copenhagen, that the politicians were weak, and they had to sell out because of economic conditions, and developers were very quick to see their chance, their legitimate right to do so. And but the result was very spread in class with, so to speak, good living areas for people, but very different row housing, freestanding blocks, high rises. What about the cohesive city, the city with the streets and squares that you love in the inner city, and the people and the city from the 19th century? I think we can do better. And actually, we do better in some of the newer areas that I describe in my book, because Sluseholm in the south harbor of Copenhagen, quite nice area. It was started just with Dutch inspiration, Dutch architect, with just before. It was around 2000, just before things went very quickly in Copenhagen, before the developers really grabbed their power. So this is a different and modern urban block area with 4 to 5, 6 stories, green areas in between, and nice streets. A little dull because it's the classical problems of getting shops enough and so on, but it's a very, very popular area, also with canals. We have other nice areas, which was one a little outside the center of Copenhagen called Grøntorv, the old green market, which has now been converted into a nice residential area with blocks, also 4 high-rises. Towers, but very nice blocks. Some of them has good size for private life or for having birthdays, children's birthday parties inside the green areas and so on. So that's why we still have a lot of good things coming with inspiration from the 1900s classical principles, when we also see that problems around. So you're right. It's an attempt to try to get a little better planning from the top and keep the principle. That's the important thing about my book. I'm not in for big crowd master plans. That's how to do it. That's how to do it. That's why I wrote the 10 principles, because the same thing people can have in mind if they are working for a smaller city or a bigger city. Though I must admit, I am mostly concerned about the bigger cities. That's the kind of architecture I think. That's also because I think the architecture is an important part of having a city like that. You have your street, your facades, and so on, your cohesive architecture. That's also under heavy pressure today because all developers, they build in different architects, different styles, and so on. So you might say that I'm a conservative in the way that I would love the city government to make some strict rules for street patterns, the public realm. Then all the talented architects can come in and fill it out with respectfully architecture against its other with qualities like not as a, in, instead of building monuments, then these tasks would call for the qualities that you is connected to infill buildings, you know, where you have to look at your neighbors and find something where you keep the unity of the street and so on. All these traditionalized, that's what I think. And it does exist around. People, I'm not the only one who's saying these things, but it's a, well, it's a, that's one I, that's a direction I want to enforce.
So it was a case of really trying to defend what was already good about the city, but you're seeing some incursions and some challenges to this model, and you wanted to define it more clearly so that people would understand, you know, what its value was and what they were potentially violating by letting developers have the run of the place. That kind of makes sense. So there's in the book you cite numerous, you know, perimeter case block a block case studies from throughout Northern Europe as an example of good planning and execution. In our field, we think of this region as a kind of utopia, but there's much to improve upon, as you point out. So, do you think any of these models can be transferred to other parts of the world where we have very different cultural characteristics and planning regimes?
And I want to add to that, as I will say his name, I once asked Ian Gale over a decade ago this exact question about what can a place like Shenzhen learn from Copenhagen, to which he insisted that we could. So I am curious, Carsten, if you feel that, because I think this is a challenge. Is Copenhagen the perfect city and we can adapt this Nordic model of urbanism everywhere? Because I find that very culturally problematic, as we say. But yeah.
To that, I would ask it. All places are different, countries are different, cities are different. And if we are talking about North America, is actually from the old time, from 1600, 1700, based from European principles in some of your great cities that are old cities that I also mentioned in my book. And then you still have blocks, urban blocks in New York, but it's just become a little higher. That's how it is. But I think that in relation to the rest of the world, I think that there may be universal is, I think that everybody, every family needs its own privacy. They need their own to have a local area that they connect with neighbors and so on, and they want safe streets and alleys and so on, depending where you are in the world. But maybe the European old way of making the connection between the inside and the outside via the windows in the street, the facades to the street with the windows and doors and gates and so on, where you constantly have this connection that you see there's life inside, and when you are inside, you can see the life on the street. I mean, it's nothing new in this. It's all the Jane Jacobs old phrase about eyes on the street. But when we talk about Latin America countries, as I know it, it's more their tradition. They never were influenced by the clear European tradition, like some cities in the Northern Americas were. They are still have been, if we see from this big Okay, this big European city with blocks. Then the private cities are more closed, and they have their private patios. And I see it in also in many also the bigger cities that their blocks are getting very, very dense. They're being filled out after little by little. All the more private, very good patios inside with a low building structure is slowly being filled out in connection with new. It's Buenos Aires I'm thinking of now, this old wonderful city based on urban blocks. Also with private patios somewhere, but anyway, things are being filled up. So in the last end, there will be no green areas inside. And but speaking more principally about Latin America, they have this tradition of on a more closed to be safe inside, a little more fortress, and then they have their private patios. Maybe this European tradition of having these streets, eyes on the streets, and more facades with more windows and doors and so on, this kind of typology can be used, I think, in Latin America countries and perhaps in other cultures in the world. So maybe we have something to offer. But of course, you have to have respect for other people's cultures. And of course, when we are talking to architecture, now here, that's why I'm in these 10 principles in my book. I'm only talking about connected, cohesive architecture, streets, and so on. But of course, every city and every place should have their own architect, their own place. Oriented qualities, their own local qualities. So I'll just in connection to this about this urban block structure mention a name and another problem or challenge that we have. In the old days, you have several people, they built their houses next to each other in the 1900 city, and today we have the big developers and the big all the big money is they want a whole block for themselves. Maybe they maybe two blocks or three blocks, and that's how another problem is the architecture is getting a little strange, too unified. But we have seen, I think it's very inspiring to see the experiments that are going on in Germany, in Tübingen, and also other places of our politicians, the cities. Trying to help people organize and build themselves, not with their own hands, but they organize and getting bank loans and so on, they can build actually their own buildings. And it's also something that people are talking about here in Copenhagen in relation to the new city parts that are not yet built. Could it not be possible to have more variety in our buildings so we get a balance between big buildings for a whole block and then have other blocks where you let people come and try to build in their own way, get something good out of that.
It sounds like you're talking about the Baugruppen principle there.
Yeah, that's exactly.
In the book, you're fairly dismissive of tall buildings as a high-density housing solution. We know that the 5 to 6 story perimeter block, is the ideal of the urban planning vanguard in many ways. But the common retort usually is not every city can be Paris. Usually people say Paris, but we'll say Copenhagen here. Would you rule out the high rise everywhere or just in the established European context?
Okay, I will not rule out the high rise. It is just, especially not for offices, but Jan Gehl's wife, she made 50 years ago research in Denmark where he concluded that found out that it was a research, found out that families should not live higher than fifth floor or something like that because the higher the family lived, the less the people came out and played with other children in the on the playgrounds on the ground because their mothers they couldn't open the window and look down and see where's my little Peter? No. So for 50 years we have known that it's a bad idea to put families into high-rise buildings. And what are we doing right now in Copenhagen? Yeah, you can still do it because you can sell it. But seen away from that, that was a little polemic because, you know, I'm talking about the Carlsberg city in Copenhagen, which is almost finished now. And from the start, it should have been this Italian village with slim defense towers. And as far as I remember, it was the meaning was from the architect that this was to be offices in these slim towers. But then the market shifted, so they couldn't sell office areas. It was for homes, for families and singles, and they all the towers were made a little bigger and a little higher. But that's another story. That's not so.
Now, you raise an interesting point, though, because, you know, it's one thing to start off with an intention to meet the office format and then to suddenly convert it to residential and just tweak it slightly. You know, not every building typology allows for that. And so I think it has something to do with the intent of the developer and the follow through as much as what the prevailing urban planning context is. So it's kind of about the negotiation that you have with the developer for them to sort of stick with the original idea that was actually approved as compatible, rather than just letting them go forward with whatever they want because they've already entitled the land. Let me ask another question that's a little bit provocative too, which is that, yes, I think you're right that there is some empirical evidence that putting people in high rises as a residential format that is just an extruded tower that extends some 25, 50, 60 stories might not be the greatest for social cohesion. Certainly we've seen lots of dystopian novels and books and movies done about that, not least of them J.G. Ballard's High Rise from way back when. But, you know, you look at places like Singapore, which is also held up as kind of an urban model of an entirely different kind, and the way that they've counteracted this is to create horizontal planes every 5, 10, 15 stories so that there is an ability for eyes on the street, even if the street in question is in the sky. So maybe that's the compromise. You know, there's like a certain scale beyond which what I've always been told is that by planners is that, you know, if you can't distinguish a human face from the window that you're looking out of, at that point you start to become alienated from your neighbors. So if we can continue to replicate the street-like environment on successive tiers in high rises so that we can still all make eye contact and figure out who's doing what, maybe we can maintain eyes on the street even as we go higher and higher.
Maybe that's possible. I wouldn't not say that's impossible. For me, the limitation is that I'm thinking about the challenge for me is to not only defend the human scale buildings, structures up to 5, 6, sometimes 7. So what I'm working with, I say let other people in other countries make these experiments that you are, or solutions that you are talking about. I will not talk that down. I say that what I am concentrating is that the modernizing the old principle, modernizing them and say, can we use it today? Can we make some very good, healthy buildings? And who need it today? I will mention one thing here in this connection with we're talking about other cultures, other countries. We have a situation that we all know in Ukraine, very unfortunate situation in Ukraine, that a country and the people who try to come over to the West and in many ways and among other things they are hoping to in the future to get an urbanism and a democracy in planning like European cities or European countries. I have been told we have just got an established an a European Ukrainian House of Copenhagen just opened here in Copenhagen. I was out talking to the leader, going around in the wonderful old building, Gamle Dock here in Copenhagen, talking to her. And she told me that people in Ukraine, and especially in the bigger cities, for many years have been fighting for more democracy, but also to get rid of all these high rises made by the oligarchs. It's just like being in Moscow, see all these different color-plated, very, very bad high-rise with no qualities on the ground, no parking, no green grid, anyway. So that's just to say, what their aim is, they're looking at the European cities, a city like Copenhagen or Berlin or other cities, can they have something that can be like that? And they have the space, they have the lots of ground, so there's no reason to build very, very, very tall. It's only for money. So what we are trying to do, my two books, How to Design Humane Cities, and my new book, Urban Block Cities, I've been so happy that they have both now been translated into Ukrainian language and published by two publishers now in the coming month. And there are conferences in urban form in taking place in Ukraine, where they all kind of people they discuss how the future can be. And I think it's very, very interesting to me if I can contribute with some ideas, old or new, for how they can do that. And one of the things I think they can, the risk in Ukraine is, I mean, it's very interesting. Will it be what kind of model will they choose? Now they have reacted against this you know, the modernist, the Soviet modernism is connected with high rise. Okay, they don't want that. They want something more low and more a process that's more democratic. So if my books can inspire some people down there to make something in that sense, in their own way, with their own architecture, I'll be very happy.
That's really interesting, because it touches on a couple of very present issues that are, you know, gripping Europe right now. So one is obviously the war in Ukraine, where mass destruction is occurring, and in some ways, the destruction reminds me of what Berlin or Rotterdam looked like at the end of, you know, World War II. Might we actually see the same kind of inventiveness? I would hope that we would, you know, into rebuilding those cities that bring in some of these principles that are not direct one-to-one imports from other places, but at least don't have that feeling of imposition that you know, reflect what the citizenry actually want, the kind of places they actually want to live in. Because they've been, you know, a lot of these block housing that they had was from the Soviet era.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think it's a good point to compare with Berlin and Hamburg after the war. And then again, I have some examples in my, I think that's my old book, so How to Design Humane Cities, where I have 10 themes of different kind of improvement on urban transformation. And one of the themes is reconstruction of old city areas that have been changed in different ways, among other things, by war. And there I have some examples for what they have done in Berlin and also in Hamburg. And I know that the structures in Ukraine cities are not the same, but anyway, it can be an inspiration to how you can connect with the old areas, the feelings, how to do things in a new way and in a modern way, fulfill the old structures so you can still have a kind of unity instead of making something totally new. So and talking about, and I know this interests you very much, it's about high rise and human scale and all that. I just want to mention Hamburg as an example of and how they can develop it. It was so that after the World War, World War II, it ended, and Hamburg was heavily destroyed. They hurried to build a lot of buildings, maybe not all very good, and something became pretty high in the 80s and the 90s, became pretty high, and it was not cohesive at all. So in about 2000, year 2000, they got a new city architect who said, "Now stop all that. We have to go back to the principle from the Gründerzeit, from about 1900, where we build in the streets and in urban blocks." And that's what they have been doing, as far as I know, and improved a lot of areas, which of which I some of them I have shown in my first book, How to Design Humane Cities. I'm talking about Katrinen area, somewhere it's just outside the Hafen area, just next to the Hafen area. That's an example of a new development that is only 5 or 6 stories and made in blocks, kind of very, very well done, sort of open blocks with very refined, very, very nice buildings. And you could also in this connection talk about Berlin, because they have had, you know, after the wall came down, and you got the Besetzerbewegung, you got a bigger interest for urban regeneration, the old housing stock getting place for the young people, and so on. Also had a very specific contribution or open up to say, now we will have no more high rises in Berlin, because the people's soul is the low dense building. You have these famous architects, they were doing all that in the IBA, Internationale Bauausstellung 1987, where they introduced all this principle of reconstruction of the European city. That was quite new. That was when you both in East and West have been some, you have been some Mercedes building, and in the West and in the East you have been some, because they were also coming out. They should, we have one in the West, you get two in the East. And so they still have that. But they, in these years in the IBA, they converted, and politically they had a master plan after long discussion that has committed themselves to the reconstruction, the reconstruction of the historic city. And they have followed that pretty much. Among other things, in this area, Friedrichswerder, that has been very known, I have written about in my first book, where they have, in 5 or 6 drawings, tried to make in a modern way a kind of old house with small facades, very varied, different housing, different. Maybe not, what you said, Baugruppen. It was not Baugruppen with the people with a little money to build in this famous place in here. But it was anyway a good example of how varied it can be when you keep, and also the structure. It's an urban block with a little green inside, and you have this different buildings with short facades, as 6 meters or something like. Then it changes, the facades changes. And what do they consist of, this building? Like in the Middle Age, they have shops and things in the ground floor. Maybe they have a doctor or dentist at the first floor, and then they have housing. So a mixed city, a dense city. So this is the kind of traditions that you could dream of, you could pass on to the Ukraine people when they get so far. Hopefully soon.
To kind of round out that subject of, okay, you know, there's kind of two dynamics here, right? One is the what do we do to repair the cities that have been destroyed by war? Then the flip side of that is we've got a continuing refugee crisis in Europe. We have an influx of immigrants coming into the northern European cities that perhaps they didn't have 2 generations ago. Do you think that the block model that you describe is sufficient to accommodate these new populations, both culturally and just in terms of numbers, because clearly the previous solution, which was, let's take the example of the French banlieue, you know, with the towers in around Paris that was famously depicted in the movie La Haine, the Hate, that didn't work out very well. So, in what ways should we anticipate the next wave of immigrant, immigration?
Yeah, it's a very good question. What comes to my mind is that the way we integrate different social groups in Copenhagen, it's that we have a law that you should have, anyway, in Copenhagen, I think it's the whole country, 25% of the new housing stock should be social housing. So, and there it's important that that happens, and it does happen in block buildings. Because, like in the old days when I grew up in 1900, you both had high and low in the same building. And today, I think it's an important element in socializing and integration of people, it would be Danish people or foreign people, as you mentioned. To say that you cannot see who is living in a big palace and who is living in a something else. So there again, you have this variation in the urban block where you can mix these things, and you can also hope that people can live together because they have these different levels of communicating with a private yard. It may be a little easier to talk to something from another country than in the streets in a different building where you never would go over. So I think we have, of course, we have in Copenhagen and in Denmark, we have special villages for immigrants, but it's only been special cases. We integrate them in housing like that. And in the bigger cities, I think if you ask any politician, they will agree with me here in Denmark about it's a way to do it in block systems in the bigger Danish cities.
Well, thank you for helping us go through this tasting of your old wine and new bottles, because I feel refreshed and I feel ready for a drink, even though it's not quite noon here.
Okay, I'm happy to hear that.
So this is Carsten Paulsen. He's the author of Urban Block Cities: 10 Design Principles for Contemporary Planning. I think there is hope for the traditional city form yet, based on his estimation. Thanks so much for your time, Carsten.
Thank you.